Hello, in this audio snippet, we would like to continue talking about the post-Civil War period and finally get to the 1876 presidential election. I'm not sure if we're going to get to that because we feel the need to share certain things related to recent events that I believe are important to share. First, I'd like to share a personal thing that happened a couple of days ago. On my lunch break, I went to the pier here in Hoboken, New Jersey, and I sat down just to on a park bench there, and just to sit there and rest a bit. And and that day it was very warm. The weather suddenly turned very warm that day. I think records were broken in many places. It was probably the hottest day in the Northeast for this date of the year since 1977. And I feel that's significant, but that's another story. The thing is that it was a very warm day, and because of that, there were a lot of people out. There's a big grassy area at the pier. So a lot of people were there suntanning and stuff. So it was very unusually full of people because of the warm weather. And I was sitting there, and I'm always, nowadays, that's so sad, you know, living in America, there is no freedom anymore. And I, one of the things that I am constantly worried about is anyone, you know, smoking cannabis. Because when the weather gets warm, then people start having more freedom to go out, and then they start smoking cannabis, and it's that stench that just fills the air, as I've shared before in these audio snippets. You can be 70, 80 yards away, and even against the wind, it's like these cannabis particles defy the laws of physics and just reach you, and with this horrible punch, it's very disturbing. So I'm always concerned, and lo and behold, I sat down and I started to smell this cannabis, and I couldn't figure out who it was, because usually the vast majority of the time it's always you know, black people or sometimes Hispanics. Every now and then it's a white person. That's been my experience. But I looked around and I couldn't see anybody that I would expect to be smoking cannabis nearby. And it took me a while until I finally realized it was these two young ladies who were kind of almost in front of me. And one of them was white. And the one that I could see, there was another one kind of lying on the grass, and I didn't notice her. But turns out that she was, I saw a puff of smoke coming out of her mouth. And I said, oh my goodness, that she was the one all this time. And, but it was interesting. It was a white person, a white, young, lady. And then I noticed that the lady that was right next to her was, kind of Hispanic looking, or maybe Indian. I'm not too sure, but she definitely was not white. And I get the feeling that they were sharing the, you know, the joint, as they call it. And I cried out a curse of judgment. Literally, not figuratively, I literally let out a curse of judgment, which you always do every time I smell cannabis in the air. You know, just like they throw cannabis smoke into the air to hit people, I throw words of cursing and judgment on them. And when I say cursing, I don't mean cursing in the sense of using cuss words. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about cursing, literally cursing, not cussing, if you know what I mean. The thing is that I think she heard me, I guess. And I don't know, I don't care. And they continued for a while, and then they stopped. And the weird thing is, then I looked a little bit to my right, and further away from me, there was this group of people, like a whole bunch of kind of university aged kids, you could say, just sitting there on the grass. And it was like seven or eight of them. And there were white people and some Indian, Pakistani looking people, and some kind of black Hispanic looking people. The thing is, it was a mixed group, and they were all passing around. They started passing around this joint, and then they started smoking, and you could see the puffs of smoke, but they were further away from me. And the wind was kind of helping, but it still was not enough to stop these physics-defying particles reaching where I was, and it's just disgusting stench. And the reason why I'm sharing all of this is that it was like that day. It's like I was, it's like I was like I went to a show. Let me put it this way, as if I was told to go to a show, and I sat down at the show, and then the stage was the stage curtains came up, and then I saw this spectacle, and it's as if I was being shown something. And what I perceived that I was being shown is the what we've shared about before, how the cancer, the evil of this country has metastasized. And you know it's metastasized when white people start acting like third world trash, and that's what I was seeing. It was like I was looking for some, the what I've always seen, a black or sometimes a Hispanic person smoking, carelessly out in public, but this time it was like this white lady. And her non-white friend, and then this big group of white people mixed in with non-white people all smoking cannabis. And it was as if I was being shown, this is what America is now. It has metastasized. What used to be the unrighteousness or certain attitudes that were concentrated in non-white people have all have spread out. It's now like acceptance, like white people have embraced this evil, and it has gotten to the point where now they are mingled, it inextricably intertwined, where you can no longer separate the two. It's like a marriage has happened, an intertwining has happened, and because this intertwining has happened, the country's gone. There is no hope. And that's what I wanted to share, this integration of evil that has happened. And it's kind of ironic that whites and non-whites, I usually don't see groups like that. It's kind of strange, even in this society, and living in this part of the country that's liberal to the hilt, and you usually just see groups of people based on, separated by ethnicity. And it's kind of, and it makes sense in a way, because liberalism is a balkanizing religion. It balkanizes people into racial groups. Everybody has to have their racial identity, and no one can copy the cultural values of another one, because that's appropriation and all this. So the liberal white fascist religion is a religion that balkanizes people, makes them think, you're not an American, you are a, blank, fill in the blank of your ethnicity. That's what you are. That's your identity, your essence, what we talked about before, that mammon thing, where you tie your identity to something external and circumstantial. And so usually I see people, a group of black people here, a group of Hispanics here, a group of white people here. But this time I was seeing this integration. It was so weird to see whites and non-whites integrated. But the sad thing is they were integrated or united around an evil act. So yes, we want integration. We want a society where people can feel like human beings and don't have to feel this thing that they owe something to their ancestors from so and so. It's like and this need to be to think of themselves in racial terms all the time. And I do believe in understanding racial dynamics, as we've done so many times in these audio snippets and in the writings that are on the website where these audio clips are posted. It's important to understand race. You can't be blind to race. Race is allows you to understand like intrinsic qualities, gifts, and because there are intrinsic gifts with each race, then there are intrinsic virtues and potential problems. Like for example, if someone is born very sociable, then this person has these positive qualities that they can socialize with people and all that. But at the same time, that virtue or that gift that they have also makes them vulnerable to certain things because they are prone to socializing. Then they're also prone to engaging in, let's say, in drinking. And then they are more prone to alcoholism than people who are not sociable. So every gift comes, it's like, as they say, it's a blessing and a curse. Sometimes the gift, allows you certain abilities, but with these abilities come vulnerabilities. So you have to understand race. And see race because that allows you to understand, okay, this race has these gifts and because of these gifts they have certain vulnerabilities. And then you look at the culture, their family, because every race is a family. You look at them and how they are interacting and see, okay, there's a pattern here. And then you identify the pattern, a cultural attitude that's either right or wrong, and then you have to call it out. Because at the end of the day, we are part of a larger, and this sounds so trite and so cliche, but as they always say, we are part of a larger family, the human race. So we have like sub-families, but when we see something wrong in one of the families, as a member of the wider family of the human race, we have to call it out and say, hey, this is this, that, and the other, to deal with the issue, because it's like a cancer. Even if you don't want to help them, if you see a race that's doing something wrong and you just ignore it, eventually it will spread out. It's like you can't ignore it. You have to deal with it in one way or another, because otherwise that thing, you cannot. Unrighteousness cannot be localized. You cannot just concentrate and put it here and say, okay, let's pretend it's in this bubble and it's not going to get out of there. No, it's eventually going to spread like a cancer throughout the rest of society, so you have to deal with it. So yes, you have to see things in terms of race to understand that. But at the end of the day, everybody's identity should be tied to something beyond race. Because race is just where you're born into. I mean, why am I accountable, or why should I be proud of of a heritage? That's so stupid. Why should I be proud of what my ancestors did? I mean, I was not there when they did it, so why should I be proud of it? Why do I take pride in something that someone else did? And also, why do I take responsibility for something that someone else did? So that's always that thing about pride, and pride in my heritage is just so ridiculous. What are you proud of? What did you do? That's what you should be, quote, proud of. So the thing is that it's sad that we're having this integration of people where race no longer matters, but it's to smoke marijuana. That's what the country has devolved into. but there's this integration of white and non-white, of first world and third world trash, that has become so inextricably intertwined that there is no hope anymore, and the country will die in what, like 5 months or so. So that's one thing I wanted to share. And the other thing that I felt was very important to share, and seems unrelated, but it's actually very related, is this thing that I've been thinking about for a while. I saw this article some days ago, and this may have been mentioned in the previous audio snippet, I don't recall. But it's an article by this man who apparently is very well known in conservative circles, Wayne Allen Root. And he has been talking apparently a lot about national divorce, that we need a national divorce, or we are headed towards a national divorce, you know, where the country will be divided into the conservatives and the liberals. And he's saying that's the solution. There is no other way to deal with it. So in his world, you know, it's the conservative mentality, the problems we have in our country is because of liberals. So we need to get away from them and be our own little conservative Idaho, our own little private Idaho of conservatism. And that's going to solve the problem, because there is nothing wrong with conservatism. Conservatism is like manna from heaven brought down from above. It is the truth. And so they live in he lives like most conservatives in this fantasy world where conservatism is the truth, and all we need is to get away from all those liberals and live in our own little bubble, and we'll be fine. So that's his solution to the problem. The article that I saw was written by him, and he was saying, I've been talking about national divorce, but he was kind of giddy about his vision of this national divorce beginning to come to pass. And he was talking about how the red states, in other words, conservative or Republican leaning states, have their economies thriving. They have low unemployment and inflation is under control in a lot of these red states. And in the blue states, the liberal states, you have rampant unemployment, inflation is through the roof, and so forth. And there might be a reality to what he's saying, but he was saying this is the beginning of it, of this separation of the red America versus blue America. And I guess so the sad thing is they do admit the defeat. You know that yes, the country is gone, but their solution is, oh yeah, the country's gone, but instead of seeing that as a moment of reflection, what did we do wrong? It's like no. It's what did they do wrong? Not there's no awareness, no self awareness of any need for change. So let's say that if there was a validity to this divorce thing, I would be for it. But the problem is there's no need for a divorce. The divorce has happened, and it's between America and the truth. And the biggest divorce has happened between the conservatives and the truth. See, liberals, as we've said a million times before, they don't care about the truth. Truth is like, what are you talking about? I don't care about truth. I care about my feelings. That's what I care about. I don't care about truth. I care about feelings. So there was never any relationship between liberals and the truth, because they couldn't care less about the truth. The relationship was between conservatives and the truth. The conservatives claim to have an awareness and an acquaintance with the truth, that they know the truth. They know what the truth looks like and so forth. But the reality is that they have only embraced half truths, and as we've said before, that leads to when you leave things half true, you leave a vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum, and it will be filled with falsehood eventually. So it's gotten to the point where they have become stuck in these half-truths that are, at the end of the day, filled with deception. And they can't hear the truth. So the truth has just said enough, and the truth has divorced conservative America. That divorce has already happened. But let's say that, let's just go that route. Let's say that what's going to happen down the road is this separation of America into the red America and blue America, and then that's going to be the salvation of this country, at least for the red part of it. Let's see how valid this thought this is. Let's do this thought experiment. First of all, we have to think, okay, there is an underlying assumption here. It's not said, but it's like these conservatives think that America is the United States is like the European Union, that we have had these sovereign states, because that's what to conservatives a state like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, these are sovereign states. We've talked about this before. It's one of the stupidities that the founding fathers left in the system from the foundation of it, federalism and all this rubbish that we've talked about ad nauseum, I guess. But the thing is that these conservatives see America as this European Union, kind of these sovereign states who've lived their lives separately and then have this evil federal government trying to hold them together and control them and tyrannize over them. But that's not the reality. The European Union, and I'm mentioning this just as a contrast. I know that they don't believe that if I said that to them, you say, oh, no, I don't think we are a European Union. The European Union is this, that, because they will do all these knee-jerk reactions. But the reason why I'm pointing out the European Union is to show the contrast between the reality of America and the reality that conservatives have in their head, which is not reality. The European Union, is all these countries that are their own government, their own cultures, their own system that they've had for centuries on their own. And they have decided to come together under this, organization in Brussels and whatever. And they have this system that kind of holds them together. And they decided on the same currency and all these things. And they have these the European Parliament and all these other stuff that are kind of like joining them together in some way. But that's not America. Even though we have tried to be like that. That's the conservative dream, to be like that, where each state is really, really their own country, and the federal government is just this loose confederacy joining them together somehow, just to keep the country together and have the semblance of a nation. That's not the reality of this country. We were never 13, at the beginning, 13 different states. It's not like England, France, Belgium, Holland and Germany and Italy, different countries that spoke different languages and had completely different histories behind them. It was the 13 colonies were basically sharing the same history, same language. I know that people in the South have a bit of an accent, and people in Boston speak, say caw in a strange way. And things like that, but yes, there are differences in accents and all that, but it's the same language, more or less the same history, and a lot of shared values, so this idea that we can separate ourselves the way the European Union can, like for example, Great Britain said, we're not going to be part of this union anymore, we're pulling out. And they pulled out, and that was that. It's not the same with the United States. We cannot do that. A state cannot just say, oh, I'm going to pull out of the rest of America, as if they had their own separate history. I hope I'm making sense. So when all these people are talking about this divorce, they are, without realizing it, thinking as if America was a European Union, but it's not. There's too much integration between the states to make a divorce feasible, at least in the way that these conservatives are envisioning it. And for example, and then there's the other thing, the ironic thing. One of the things that conservatives always say about federalism, oh, federalism is such a wonderful system left by our founders. And I hate that term, you know, when they say our founders. It's like there is almost this idolatry, like they are looking up at a statue of some worthless saint and lighting a candle to it. They almost have that same look, the same feeling of the words that comes out of their mouths. It's just pagan idolatry. So our founders so cleverly put together the system of federalism where each state is their own experiment. We can try laws here, and if those laws are not good, then people will walk with their feet and go to another state where the laws are better. So we have this free market of laws and ideas. And so that's what conservatives always talk about, you know, walking with your feet. So if you don't like life in New Jersey, then you have to pack your bags and go down to DeSantis's Florida and live your life there. And once Florida elects some piece of trash Democrat, then we'll have to walk with our feet to, you know, nearby Alabama or Mississippi or whatever. And once it becomes insufferable there, then we have to go, you know, wherever. So we become these nomads walking around from state to state. But the thing is that there is freedom of movement. Obviously freedom in quotes, because every move, it's not, you can't just pick up and go as if nothing, you know, it's not like choosing between going to one restaurant versus the other. You have to change your whole life, and it's expensive. Some people cannot afford to move. So the thing is that, but there is relative freedom of movement. So yes, now let's take that freedom that these conservatives always use as a validation of federalism, and now look at it, apply it to this divorce situation. Yeah, you can have some red states thriving for a season, but we've known this, we've seen this phenomenon where if a red state is prospering, then and a blue state nearby is failing, what happens? The people from the blue states are going to the red state, because there are more opportunities there. And once they're in the red state, they start voting for Democrats and liberalism. And they start voting for the very things that destroyed their original state. And then they turn the red state purple. And eventually, in some cases, they turn it blue. So how are you going to stop this, Wayne Allyn Root, and bet your band of conservatives? Are you going to put up walls around the states so that only, you know, and then have people like customs and you know, like you're entering a different country. So if you come from a liberal state, you're going to be stopped at the border and you have to show your papers and you have to have a visa to validate how long you're going to be in that red state so that you don't contaminate it with your blueness. I mean, how the hell are you going to keep? See, the thing is, what I'm talking about is the integration is too deep. So the integration is too deep. So how are you going to prevent blue states from contaminating red states? See, if you have an aroma in a place, the aroma will spread. There's a term for it, diffusion or something. I'm not sure. But the thing is, you can't. The smell does not stay concentrated in one area. It will spread out because it's like by the laws of entropy or whatever, the second law of thermodynamics or whatever, it just spreads out until eventually it homogenizes the smell across, you know, the environment. You know, just like the thing with cannabis, even though cannabis is a little more aggressive than regular smells. But the thing is that, so if you have a contamination in a blue state, it is going to spread to the states around it until because there's this natural tendency to homogenize. So, you know, good luck trying to control blueness going into your holy ground, red states. Once this divorce happens, there is no way for that to be done. It is like trying to fight the wind. You can't stop it. You can stop it, but you have to go at a higher level. But conservatives live like pigs at the lower level of the ground, so they cannot go up to the higher level and do what needs to be done to stop these sorts of things. It's like to them, you know, to fight problems, we just need our Second Amendment rights. We need guns. We need our guns will protect our sovereignty. You know, and we've had the Second Amendment in the country for so long. How has that helped us? You know, erode the tyranny that's been going on. It's like trying to fight a ghost with a gun. You know, you can shoot bullets at it, and it's not going to do a thing. So, but if you fight the ghost with ghostly powers, whatever that means, then you can defeat it. But conservatives don't understand this. So they believe in this magical divorce solution that's not going to work. And on top of that, let's say that you do have like some sort of secession, that the South secedes a second time, and the red states in the South become this confederacy, this second version of the confederacy. Let's say you have this divorce, then what's going to happen after that? You know, all these people that are living, let's say, in Mississippi or Alabama, they've been paying into the federal government with their federal taxes all this time. And they've been paying Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all this rubbish. All these years paying into the system. And we know the liabilities, unfunded liabilities of the federal government. It's just money thrown, it's almost like throwing it into a chimney fire. And that's what they've been doing. But they have an expectation that when they retire, these people in Alabama and Mississippi and so forth in Georgia, they will be able to collect Social Security because they've paid into it all their lives, and they'll be able to collect Medicare and Medicaid. What happens when they secede? Do you think that the federal government's going to, you know, hand out a check and say, oh, okay, here is your part of the Social Security fund that you paid into our pot? Do you think that's going to happen? I mean, if you guys, conservatives, think that that's going to happen, you're more delusional than I thought. It's not going to happen. The moment that divorce happens, all these unfunded liabilities don't go away. Now the state government will have to step in and put in the money that the federal government did not pay. So the thing is, what I'm trying to say is, we are economically tied, and if you should try to be dealing with the underlying roots that have led to the unfunded liabilities to begin with to prevent the disaster. Instead of saying, oh, we can hide away from the disaster in our red states. No, because eventually the unfunded liability is going to hit you whether you like it or not, even if you secede from the federal government. And then on top of that, there's the other issue that the financial system, the banking system, is controlled by the left, by liberalism. The majority of people on Wall Street are liberals. The majority of people in the banking system lean hard to the left, and they control the banking system. So what happens when there's a secession in the red states, separate, the financial system that has in a way funded economic activity in the country for decades and decades, that system is going to stay in the blue states. So what is the left? The red states. What are they going to do to recover from that? And I'm going to tell you what they're going to do. They're going to lean towards gold. I saw this story recently about Texas passing a bill, if I'm not mistaken, where they were going to require that, or proposing a bill that would require that digital currencies be tied to gold. So they, and I've been hearing conservatives talk about gold, 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 like going back to the gold standard, and you know, because, and they talk about this fiat currency and all this stuff. So they will return to gold. But gold, as we've tried to explain so many times in these audio snippets, the gold standard is a shackling standard that is anti-common sense, anti-reality, anti-truth. It is an artificial thing. Why not four-leaf clovers? Why not unicorns? Why not? I mean, if you wanted to tie your currency to something rare, why is it gold? And why, if you find gold on the ground, suddenly you have more wealth and more resources? It's all very artificial. But aside from that, we've been talking about how the Panic of 1873 led to the loss of elections in 1874 by the Republicans, and that's when the Republican Party kind of that's when America suffered a moment of death, because we allowed the Democrats to take control of the House a mere 9 years after the end of the Civil War, after the Democrat Party had done so much damage and evil and harm to the country. We said, okay, all is forgiven. We give you back the control because the Republicans mismanaged the economy. And why were the Republicans mismanaging the economy under Grant? Because Grant was obsessed with the gold standard. And the gold standard, they passed a bill that prevented this, silver being used as a as a an alternative standard. And Grant said, no, we want to concentrate on gold. And that led to the Panic of 1873, led to the downfall of the economy, and led to the Democrats taking over. It's so ironic that the Republicans are going back to the very thing that led to the beginning of the downfall of the Republican Party. And it has it's what kept the it's ironically the gold standard is what kept America in the Depression. In the Great Depression during the during Polio Boy's years, you know, FDR, son of a bitch, burning in hell right now, that little bastard boy kept America under a deep depression that whole time, because he was also committed to the gold standard. And just as a side note, I as a you know, years ago, I would always be puzzled. When people would talk about how, and even conservatives, they would say, "Hey, FDR kept us down," and he did. You know, he kept the economy artificially. He created a malaise, and people became accustomed to this malaise and this sense of we will never recover. And even though, you know, we had the ability to recover, we were in a state of mind that we were not recovering. And on top of that, we had the gold standard being imposed on the economic system, so we were limiting economic activity psychologically and through the gold standard. And people, conservatives, always say, "Well, what happens when? Why did we come out of the Depression? Because World War II came along, and that, you know, ramped up economic production, and we finally got out of it." And that's how they explain that, you know, FDR is not the one who took got us out of the Depression. He kept us in the Depression. And the thing is, he used it as a way to have people become dependent on him. So people, you know, he was their consoler, their comforter, the one who came, out on the radio every Sunday or whatever. He would have this regular speech that he would give out on the radio, and people would gather around the radio, the families, and listen to him and his comforting voice. That, you know, so he became this soother. He prolonged the malaise so that he could act as the soothing voice that people depended on to go to survive through the malaise that he was enabling. That's how he got to be reelected three times. That's how he became a four-term president. But the thing is that conservatives always say, well, we came out of the Depression because of World War II. And that's always puzzled me to no end. I mean, that's so strange because I would say to myself, how can war bring us economic prosperity? Because war is, in essence, you know, you're building things to go kill people, and you're not building, you're not making, how can I say this? Making clothes. You're not producing food. You're not making houses. You are actually creating things to go destroy stuff. And so forth. So how can war make us richer? You see what I'm trying to say? Some people say, well, corporations become richer. No, but forget that. I don't want to get into that. That's a whole different story. And it's a waste of time going into that. People are so confused about that. But the thing is that I'm talking about the whole society. America came out of the Great Depression through World War II. And even though we were now investing resources into producing things that were going out to Europe to go kill people, and it was a good thing because we were fighting the Nazis and all that. I'm not questioning that at all. What I'm trying to say is we were not feeding people. We were not clothing people. We were not building houses. We were not doing anything. We were producing for the purpose of destroying. What was always puzzling to me, why in the world was that, why did that make us richer? And the answer is very simple. The thing is, once World War II came along, then this malaise and this stagnation that was also triggered by the gold standard could no longer be maintained. Because now we had to start working. It's like, you know, people just lounging around about and, just sitting there doing nothing because they were told they had nothing to do. And then suddenly there was something to do and they were forced to get up and start. It's like it triggered economic activity. And on top of that, because we needed to produce all this equipment and all this stuff, then the government had to get away from the gold standard and had to start borrowing and producing, in other words, to make a long story short, what happened is, first of all, the psychological removal of economic inactivity was lifted, and second, the money supply was allowed to grow again. So it's ironic that something that's so destructive and expensive, because war is expensive on a society, it drains resources from a society. And sometimes war isn't necessary. I'm not questioning war per se, but I'm saying it is a draining activity. But ironically, this draining activity became the justification for removing the artificial news or artificial kind of fence that had been placed around the money supply because of the gold standard. And that's why the World War II got us out of the Great Depression, because it forced us to free ourselves from the shackles that we have placed on ourselves artificially. But the thing is, when the Red States, if they divorce and they form their own country or whatever, they're going to have to suffer the shock of separation from the financial system that is currently controlled by blue states, New York, and places like California and all these places that control the financial system, they will first of all have to break away from that, and then they're going to replace it with their own conservative brand of a financial system that's going to be tied to the gold standard, and what we're going to see in those red states is stagnation. And in the meantime, and as you see stagnation, you know what's going to happen. People are going to get upset. You know, they're not going to get their pensions. They're not going to get, their economic activity is going to stop. They're going to get upset. And what's going to happen is the same thing that happened in 1874. These red states that always vote Republican are going to start voting for people who are not Republican or who are not conservative because their economy is in the tank. Because Americans have always been these superficial bastards when it comes to voting, where we vote based on our economic situation. So, with some exceptions, with Obastard, it seemed like it didn't matter how bad we were, and with FDR too, because we were duped. But that's a different story. But generally, when we're not in a state of hypnosis, we tend to vote based on the latest economic data, not on deeper issues. But the thing is that what's going to happen in these red states is they are going to start voting non-red. And so the malaise, it's, the integration is so deep that you cannot stop the blue stench from reaching your state with a gun. You can't point a gun at the stench of the blue state nearby. It's going to come into your red state. Eventually, it's going to take it over. And divorce or no divorce, you're going to be as dead as the blue state next to you. Eventually. I hope I'm making sense. This national divorce thing, it's not going to work. The country's dead. The country is dead. And you are not going to have these portions of the country that are saved, and these portions that are dead. It's going to be overall death, because there is no recognition of the truth. This simple concept about the gold standard, and what we've discussed, that the alternative is the right solution is to have a money supply that's tied to GDP growth and constitutionally tied, where it's not a question of someone deciding to increase the money supply. No. By constitutional law, the money supply is tied to GDP growth, because the money supply is a point system. That's all it is. And it is ludicrous to say there are more points on the board because somebody found gold on the ground, or less points because no one found gold. No, the points in the system should be based on the goods and services that are being produced. I don't care how much gold is in somebody's, coffers. What I care is, about food that I can eat, a television set that I can watch, a computer that I can use, a lamp that I can turn on, real things. That is wealth. Those are goods and services. That's what we need is a system where every good and service has a stable point system, so that when people exchange goods and services, you don't have to go back to the barter system to have it done. And if the point system is unreliable, it creates instability. That's one of the things that led to a lot. We could have grown so much more as a nation economically, even before the 20th century, if we had stayed away from the gold standard from the beginning, because when we tighten the money supply and tie it to an artificial metal, scarce metal, especially gold, what we do is create deflationary tendencies, and that happened a lot during the 19th century in America. And what happens when deflationary tendencies happen is that, because there are more goods and services, but there are fewer points. It's like the same number of points have to cover more goods and services, and that means that that every dollar is more expensive. Is supposed to represent a greater percentage of the goods and services available. So when you have that, then that disincentivizes borrowing and investing, because what's the point of borrowing money to start a business if when you pay back your lender, the dollar that you pay back is more expensive than the dollar that he lent to you. So that punishes investment, and people cannot think in the long term. It's better just to leave the money sitting there, you know, just like gold, you know, people always say, oh, if I have bought gold 25 years ago, it'd be worth like $300,000 instead of $12,000. I've seen commercials about that on television. Yeah, that's what gold does. The gold standard, it disincentivizes economic investment because it's just better to let it sit there, just like gold, and wait until it's worth more money. So that kind of causes a channeling of resources into these warehouses instead of allowing those resources to be circulated and produce more wealth. So, and that simple concept, if all these idiots had been listening to the truth, they would have received this simple concept that we're sharing these audio snippets, and you're hearing this simple concept about how to transform the money supply. This simple thing would have transformed the economy of the United States. It would have transformed, and then when it would have caught on, it would have transformed the economies of the entire planet Earth. That's how powerful this little simple principle that we're sharing here is. And I think most people, you know, even some who would listen to these audio snippets do not realize the power of this little concept. It would have transformed the economy of the world if people had listened to it. Just a simple truth. And we went, I guess, through some of the details of how, you know, the money supply would be tied to the GDP. And then if the GDP shrank or for some reason, we would keep the money supply under a certain level, wait for the GDP to catch up to the money supply, and then let it continue growing. So there are some details to the simple concept. There are nuances, but the concept itself is simple. Tie the money supply to the GDP and forget about gold standards and all this rubbish, because Oh, and by the way, one of the reasons we began to prosper in the mid 19th century is when we found gold in California. And you could say, oh, you're contradicting yourself. No. You know what happened when we found gold in California? Then we finally were able to increase the money supply so that the economy could be allowed to grow. It's not that, how can I say this? We artificially bound ourselves to the gold standard. So we had to find gold in order to grow. So when we found gold in California, then that allowed the economy that was already kind of like waiting for this influx of money supply to grow. So when it came in, it began to expand. So when finding gold is not necessarily associated with wealth. Look at the Spaniards. They found all this gold in the Americas. They took it back to Spain. And Spain became so saturated with gold that, they didn't, and because their economy was not producing and they were not bent on producing, they felt that they were going to live off of the gold from the Americas. Then their country stagnated and Spain became one of the poorest countries in Europe for a long time. Now they have kind of recovered a bit. But for a long time, Spain was one of the more backward, poor, third worldish countries in Europe. And so finding gold does not make you rich. It's just that if you have artificially tied yourself to gold for your money supply and you have a thriving economic machinery, you need to have more gold be added to the point system so that you can start, growing again. That's why we grew. It's like, I don't know. I could go on about this, but it is very saddening to me personally to know that there's this golden nugget, speaking of gold, this golden nugget, this golden concept that could have transformed the economy of the entire planet Earth. And it's here being given to the American people on a silver, speaking of silver, on a silver platter, this golden nugget on a silver platter, this concept, you America who are so obsessed with the economy, you vote based on economic data, here's this economic concept that is going to transform your economy forever, and you said that. Because you don't want to listen to the truth. and you'd rather divorce blue states and divorce the truth than admit to it, admit that you that your understanding of reality is incomplete. And speaking of divorce, and that I saw this article, and I'm going to go to it right now, on the Gateway Pundit, this conservative website that I often go to. They had a headline that said, "Essay: State Legislatures Have the Power to Resist Federal Tyranny." So there was this fellow from the Louisiana something something, Louisiana Citizen Advocacy Group. The man's name is Christopher Alexander, and my intention is not to embarrass him or anything, but you know, he put his name on it, so I might as well say it. Let me read parts of this, and this is, when I read this, I feel disgusted reading it, because I there's so much idolatry, you know, oozing out of the mouth of this person as he, you know, says this, these words. So he said, "America's founders fought a bloody revolution in order to escape the absolute despotism to which they had been reduced under the hereditary monarchy of the British government, a system that Thomas Paine said laid the world in blood and ashes. After that revolution was won, the founders' singular focus was to create a republic that would safeguard individual freedom and state sovereignty by vesting only limited, specifically enumerated powers in a federal government. The Constitution's first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, as well as the 9th and 10th Amendments, establish clear limitations on the power of the federal government and make clear that all power not specifically delegated to the federal government remains with the people and the individual states." And that thing, remains with the people and the individual states, that's a cop-out. It's the people part, you can cross it out. It remains with the individual states, not the people. I mean, because that's one thing that conservatives have to admit often, you know, they have to admit when it says we the people, when the people are referred to, they're really referring to the states and to the state legislatures. That's what they're referring to, not to the actual people. But okay, but that aside. So he then says, "Our founders were jealous guardians of state sovereignty and individual freedom because they knew too well the dangers of an unrestrained government. The Constitution, the writings of the founders, and the notes from the ratification conventions establish, this guy talks like he's talking about something that God dictated to Moses on the mountaintop. I mean, that's how, but that established that every state that ratified the Constitution knew it was doing so with the assurance that it was retaining the vast bulk of its sovereignty, with full authority to nullify any federal law the state believed was outside the scope of its delegated authority. Without this assurance, the Constitution would never have been ratified." This is the same principle that they always say, you know, it was the states were the ones who gave birth to the Constitution, not the other way around. In other words, that they're saying, we the states, we decided to give the Constitution credibility. If it weren't for us, the Constitution would be nothing. We decided to give it life. So that's the problem. These people believe that the state, that America was these bratty, 13 bratty little states saying, okay, we're going to be a country, but, you know, don't tread on me, you know, don't mess with me, you know, liberty or death. As I saw this, I think it was on that same day that I saw this thing that I was telling you at the pier. As I was walking back, I saw this guy who had this "Don't Tread on Me" t-shirt in the back. It said, "Don't Tread on Me, Liberty or Death," which is kind of an odd thing to see, you know, blue state, like, you know, where I live. And I saw it, and it has this a coiled snake, you know, ready to strike, with the don't tread on me thing. And I said to myself, you know, that's the that's conservatism in a nutshell. Like this angry snake, like don't mess with me. When the statement should be don't tread on unrighteousness. Don't tread on the truth. Don't tread on liberty and freedom. You fight for a principle. It's not like when you say don't tread on me, it's like say, okay, as long as you don't mess with me, I don't care about you. But you mess with me, you mess with my interests, and then I'm going to fight back. That's the utmost selfishness. No, I don't care if you're not treading on me. If you're treading on someone else and you're violating that person's rights, then it's my problem. That's the attitude. It's like you fight for a principle, not just because you're being impacted personally. But the thing is that the founding that these conservatives think that the 13 bratty states said, okay, you know, we're going to form this country, but you know, don't tread on me. If you dare to tread on me, I'm going to throw a temper tantrum, throw a wobbly, and I'm going to get out of here. Instead of what should have happened and what in a way kind of happened somehow in a partial way against these people's wills was that when the United States was born, it was supposed to be 13 states surrendering their will to a common will of a nation. It was not a saying like a concession. You see what I'm trying to say? It's a surrender. It's not the 13 states doing this some sort of minor concession to kind of hold us together as a makeshift nation. No, it was supposed to be. It's like in a marriage, you surrender. It's like there's a death. It's a death. You're making a commitment and you're dying in a way. So there's a death going on. It's a surrender, where you stop thinking about yourself and you think about a larger thing. So that's what should have happened. And it never really happened in this country. But ironically, despite the fact that it never really happened, we still suffer the consequences as if it had happened in the negative sense. So there was no real integration in a good sense, but the integration happened in such a way that now we cannot avoid being contaminated by others' unrighteousness. I hope I'm making sense. It's like we didn't want to get married, but we kind of got married anyway, and we don't enjoy the benefits, the good things about marriage, because we're not really in a marriage, but we have to suffer the bad things about marriage, all the bad burdens and problems that come with the marriage. We live that, but we don't live the benefits of a real marriage because it was never real. So the thing is here, it says, our founders knew that the federal government is never going to voluntarily limit its own power, and it was up to vigilant state governments and active citizens to do so, beginning with the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions in 1798, and for 100 years thereafter, states did just that, routinely rejecting unlawful federal encroachment through formal nullification resolutions and citizen resistance. So, you know, so you read this stuff and you go, my goodness, part of this resistance that the states had against the federal government was when the southern states were resisting any attempt by the federal government to end slavery. But that, for some reason, doesn't seem to be remembered in these people's heads as they speak out all this rubbish. All this worthless piece of crap that they speak out. And let me read the final part of this. It says, with the encouragement of active citizens, the Louisiana legislature must give the back of its hand to the federal government and to any international organization with which it may be colluding. The next time it pokes its heavy, bloated head inside our sovereign tent, the days of reflexive compliance with federal tyranny must end. We will be watching closely and reporting broadly by name. J. Christopher Alexander. So this is, and I said, the next time when I saw this part that said the next time it pokes its heavy bloated head inside our sovereign tent, and that's exactly the same words that Southerners were using when they said we are seceding from the Union because Lincoln is coming to take away our slaves, and his heavy bloated head or hand is coming inside our sovereign tent, our southern tents. So I go, my goodness, you know, talking about the tyranny of government. Well, isn't state government government? Or what is this magical thing, you know, that's called the state? Is it some sort of like a voluntary organization that people join? Is it this magical place in the sky where that's called the state? No, it's a government. You find it in Sacramento, you find it in Trenton, you find it, you know, wherever, you know, there's a capital, state capital, and there's the state legislature. That's the state. It's state government. So if the founders were so concerned about the tyranny of government, as this idiot wrote somewhere around here, the tyranny of government, was it just federal government? Is that all we have to worry about? As long as we're being tyrannized and we're being raped by the state government, then it's not tyranny. But if it's being done by the federal government, we're being raped by the federal government, then we have to complain. It's Sacramento. Look at California. There's the tyranny of the state government in Sacramento. Well, if you don't like it, walk away from it. Again, it's that, I don't know. I cannot explain. It's like trying to talk to an idiot. It's talking to conservatives is beginning to get to the point of being almost equivalent to talking to liberals, because a liberal doesn't care about truth. Conservatives care about truth, but only halfway. But it gets to the point when you try to fill out the other half that they start behaving like liberals who don't compute, don't put two and two together. The thing is that this national divorce thing that that conservatives envision, like the solution to our problems, is not going to to solve anything. And just to finish this out, I'll try to be very quick. And this is related. There's been this boycott of a beer here in America, Bud Light, because promotion that involved this person who has this trans a man who's trying to be a woman, and they used his face in some beer cans and beer tins, and that became this big controversy, and a lot of people are boycotting the beer, and Bud Light has suffered major losses in the billions because of it, and to me that was I mean, you would say, oh, wow, you know, it's like conservatives see this as a sign. They grab onto this and see it as a sign. Yes, we are fighting back, America, blah, blah, blah. And they see it as part of also the, you know, the people who are thinking in terms of the national divorce see this as, yes, we have enough people to be our own nation and people with enough resolution to be our own little red nation. Ironic that we use the word red for that, because I remember back in the day when the color red was not a good color when it came to political conversation, because it was tied to communism. It's so ironic. So the thing is that they believe that we have an American population that is not completely sold out on the liberal nonsense. But to me, that whole thing is just very depressing. For several reasons, it tells me, ironically, this strong boycotting of Bud Light shows to me the weakness of the American resolution. And you say, why? Well, because I see that the NFL, the National Football League, you know, the American Football League, has come back to almost its previous popularity. You know, they started doing the kneeling. I started boycotting the NFL before the kneeling happens for reasons that are too long to explain here. I felt that there was something wrong with the league. It happened with Super Bowl 52. I forget the number. It was Georgia, Atlanta lost to the Patriots in that Super Bowl. And when I saw that, I saw, okay, there's something very wrong here. There was something very worthy and righteous about that league. And it began to decay, decay, decay. And then when it hit that Super Bowl, I knew it was over. And I said, I'm going to boycott them for a year. And then I waited for the year to end, and I was eagerly awaiting to start watching them again. And then they started doing the, they did something else or whatever. And then eventually they did the BLM kneeling nonsense. And I said, I'm not watching them anymore. And a lot of people ended up, you know, doing the boycott around that time, and the popularity of the NFL quickly declined. But now it's back almost to the same level. So the people who had boycotted them didn't have enough resolution or integrity. I mean, stadiums should be half empty, especially in the South. I mean, no one should be going to Houston or Dallas or you know, Jacksonville or whatever to watch anything from the NFL. The stadium should be empty if they really, really meant their, you know, commitment to ending that. So baseball stadiums should be empty. Baseball has become rubbish. And as a side note, you know, I think this year they started with adding time to baseball. Like the pitchers have to throw a pitch within a certain amount of time. And to me, that's a sign that America is done. Its time is up. Because the moment they perverted baseball with introduction of a chronometer, they destroyed the game. And that to me is a sign that time is up. The country is gone. Its time in history is gone. But that's a side note. The thing is that if America had this that actually was this resolute about upholding values and blah blah blah, then baseball stadiums should be empty. Football stadiums should be empty. Basketball stadiums, especially in the south, in red states, should be empty. Basketball arenas should be empty. But why is there no, you know, no boycotting, permanent boycotting of these events? Because America is always about interest, self-interest. They like football, they like baseball. They were bored, especially after the lockdowns and all and everything. They wanted to get back to normal and normality, and that was their way to get back to that. So they didn't have enough resolution. You know, hold, you know. Not buying Bud Light. Well, you can go buy Heineken anyway, or buy, you know, Miller or whatever, or who knows what other brand. So there's other beers you can choose from. But with the NFL, there's only one league. With Major League Baseball, there's only one league. So if they were really resolute, they would punish these sports and these leagues and turn them away from their wokeness. But they're not. So to me, them boycotting a beer is like meaningless. And on another side note, it's I'll have to be very frank. If you've listened to these audio snippets, you know what my stance is on all those transsexual things and all that stuff. But I will be very frank with you. When I see that person, the person that was the center of the controversy, the man who's, you know, who the transvestite who's in the center of this controversy, when I see him, instead of feeling outraged, I feel great sorrow, to the point almost I feel almost like crying. I feel bad for the guy. I really feel bad for him, and I it's not like with others that I feel this outrage because there's an arrogance or something. I feel bad for him. I really, really feel bad for him. And it, not that he's going to, I'm not,
Don't get me wrong, I'm not feeling bad for him over the controversy. I'm feeling bad for him as a person. I feel sorrow for him, for his state of mind, his situation. I really, really feel sorrow for him. And so it's interesting that when America becomes resolute, or the American conservatives become resolute about fighting something, it's against a person like this one. And they don't feel the same resolute drive against people who are more blatantly evil. I don't know how to explain it. It's like there was this weakness here. I don't know how to explain it. I feel sorrow for this person. Profound sorrow. It's like the person is vulnerable and weak. The person needs help. And I really feel bad for him. Really, to the point that I almost feel like crying for him. And it's interesting that conservatives are choosing to be resolute with this person in particular. I'm not questioning the resoluteness of boycotting the beer. I would have boycotted the beer to begin with. I boycott a whole bunch of stuff. So that's not the issue. I mean, I don't even drink beer anyway. But that's not my point. My point is, it's interesting to me how resolute we became with this person in this issue, and with other issues where there should be much more of anger and resolute boycotting. There is none of it. And then there was this comment by Donald Trump Jr. About this, and he was saying, let's not boycott Bud Light. This is bad because of one mistake. We shouldn't punish this American company. And he said, this company, Anheuser-Busch, donates 60 to 40% percent in favor of Republicans. So they give money to Democrats and Republicans, but they give to Republicans by a margin of 60% to 40%. And he said that's unheard of in the current American corporate woke structure. And that is true. You know, and then he said the CEO is a former Marine, a Republican, and most of his life, adult life, and all that. And yeah, it might be true. And he said, and this company has given money to a lot of Republicans, including Kevin McCarthy. And to me, there was sadness in this statement because, first of all, you know, 60-40, it's like, okay, they are kind of like, feeding both sides to, be sure, hedging their bets kind of thing. But, and yes, they're giving more to Republicans, but to me, there's a problem per se with companies giving money to anybody. And we've talked about this before, that in the new American Constitution, it would have been different. No company should be allowed to donate any money to anything. Charity organizations should not be allowed. It all should be individual donations, and with a limit, a very short limit of how much each individual can give, no matter how wealthy or poor they are. They only can give up to a certain amount. But no one talks about that. We have to end the system. And there should be no political action committees, nothing. Like, you cannot give as a group. It's always individuals. So that sort of financial campaign reform should be happening, but no one's going to the deeper root of the issue. It's just all surface stuff. And the fact that he, he's giving money to Republicans, that's another thing. The whole lobbying system should be dismantled. A lot of it would be dismantled just by virtue of companies not being able to donate money to a candidate. But the whole lobbying system should also be dismantled. We talked about that in a previous audio segment, if I'm not mistaken. But the fact that he's bringing these things up and not realizing that he's talking about problem issues in the American underlying system is mind-boggling. It's like we're dancing around the problems and dealing with surface issues, but not dealing with the root issues. So as he's trying to explain that we should not be boycotting Bud Light, he is explaining all these other things that are wrong with the country, but not realizing that he is. You see what I'm saying? And the sad thing is, the CEO, this former Marine, issued a public statement, and it was the most non-apology that I've ever seen. It's not even an apology, that he doesn't even try to apologize. He just says, we don't want to divide, we want to unite people over a beer, and this and the other. So it's kind of interesting, this is all in the context of this national divorce and separation and integration stuff that we've been talking about. So he doesn't want to divide people, he wants to unite people over a beer, and we're going to make sure to maintain our values and maintain American values, this, that, and the other. But he didn't really apologize for having done this campaign with this transsexual person. So one wonders, you know, why is Donald Trump Jr. supporting him? But that's another story. And speaking of McCarthy, to whom this Anheuser-Busch has donated money, he's still not done anything about the January 6th videos and all the stuff that has come out. The January 6th prisoners are still, trapped and being punished politically as political prisoners. And in the meantime, Jim Jordan has been doing hearings about, Uncle Tom in Manhattan, Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, who pressed charges against Trump. And he's holding hearings, but it's all hearings about how bad Alvin Bragg is and all this stuff. And you go, what's the point? You know, what concrete, instead of doing something concrete to, you know, as we've explained before, just pass a law that that prevents this sort of thing. You know, just put out a bill and pass it, instead of just all these meaningless hearings that achieve nothing. And McCarthy also pretended like he was going to do something with the videos, and he did nothing. So we're still in this nothingness where people just sometimes pretend like they're going to cross the Jordan, and they just walk along the Jordan and then go back. And where is Trump? Speaking of Donald Trump Jr., where is his father? He was the one who got all the Republicans to vote for McCarthy, calling them during that whole controversial election of him as Speaker of the House. So he has supposed influence on McCarthy. Why isn't he calling McCarthy and telling him, hey, what's going on with the videos? Why aren't you releasing them? Why aren't you fighting to get these people free? You know, there's none of that. So it's all talk. It's all idle actions, and nothing is happening. So that's why the country's dying. The conservatives have placed their hope on a national divorce, but we are too integrated, too joined to at the hip as a nation to really be able to do that. It is naive, and if the red states ever do separate in a significant way, they're going to suffer big time, big consequences. Because they will bind themselves to a gold standard. They will not be, they will not, they'll have to compensate for the unfunded liabilities that they never dealt with at the federal level, with the Social Security pensions and all that stuff, Medicare, Medicaid, all these promises to all these taxpayers who paid into the system and will not get anything back, especially if they separate from the federal system. And then they will, tie their own economies with the gold standard. And they will, in the meantime, have people from the blue states creeping in into their borders and into their red states and purpleizing them. And as the economy goes bad, those red states are going to, the people in those red states are going to rebel against conservatives and Republicans, and then eventually they will fall too. So there is no hope. And in the meantime, these divorce-promoting conservatives are again speaking out about federalism and about talking about the tyranny of the federal government and this, that, and the other, and they still refuse to understand you don't separate government by federal and state. Government is government, and if government is corrupt, government is corrupt. If government is tyrannical, it's tyrannical no matter whether it's state or federal. And you have to establish things in the system to protect the people from the government. Not from the federal government, from the government, whether it be state or federal. And there's nothing in the system for that. The Constitution protects states, doesn't protect individuals. We've explained it a million times. The 11th Amendment is the prime example of that. I mean, if you have any questions about it, the 11th Amendment is the absolute proof that individual rights are subservient to state rights under the American Constitution. But these people don't care, and they think they can take cover in federalism, take cover from the destruction of the country. And federalism is just it is nonsensical, it is delusional, and because it's against the truth is not going to let them hide in their federal little bunkers, federalism bunkers. And America is going to collapse as a whole, from top to bottom, from Maine to Los Angeles, from Seattle to Miami. It's going to be a generalized collapse of the country, and the red states might suffer a slower collapse, but eventually they will fall. The country will decay into third world status, and the death is going to start happen. The death is going to become official in around 5 months, and that's when we will become a third world country. And yes, the collapse is not going to be immediate, but we're going to be on our way. The country's done. The country is over. The relevance of this nation is over. I hope that the people who have listened to the truth, who are willing to live by the truth, are able to somehow survive or make it out of this destruction that is coming. It's a collapse, and it's a sad collapse, a cultural collapse, a total collapse of this country. It's not going to happen immediately, but it will be official in 5 months that we will be dead as a nation. And I hope that if you are one of the good ones, that you are able to somehow have some sort of bubble of protection or be able to leave the country. It is so sad. I'm really, really sad that this country that has so much promise is dead. It just doesn't want to listen to the truth and live. It just doesn't want to. So, okay. You get what you ask for, and you are going to get it in 5 months or less. Thank you very much for listening.